Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from Space Beans Coffee, committed to fueling the daily journey from morning grogginess to the peak of productivity, offering a variety of brews, including Go for Launch, Dark Side of the Moon, Rocket to Mars, and more. Available at their Melbourne cafe or online at spacebeans.com.
Starship's air traffic disruptions and uncertainty ahead for NASA science. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. Last week, SpaceX's Starship spacecraft broke apart during a test flight. The debris from the rapid unplanned disassembly prompted the ground stoppage of many airline flights from Florida. The issue highlights the relationship between air traffic and space traffic. We'll speak with Ruth Stilwell of Aerospace Policy Solutions LLC about the current plans and future needs for airplanes and spacecraft to share the same sky. Then NASA announced efforts to reduce its workforce, a reaction from new policy changes under the Trump administration, and the budget for NASA's science division could also be in jeopardy. We'll speak with the Planetary Society's Casey Dreyer about the cuts and what's ahead for the future of funding science at NASA. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? During SpaceX's recent test of its massive Starship, the spacecraft broke apart after what SpaceX calls a rapid unplanned disassembly. Streaks of debris from the spacecraft could be seen in the sky over much of Florida. The debris event disrupted airline flights from Orlando, Miami, and Fort Lauderdale. So, how do we manage the sky with both spacecraft and airplanes sharing the same airspace? Here to answer those questions is Ruth Stilwell, the Executive Director at Aerospace Policy Solutions, LLC. Ruth, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, Ruth, we're here to talk about the Starship explosion last week. And while, you know, we're used to seeing SpaceX blow things up in the name of iterative design and learning from mistakes, this one had some real-world impacts as debris was raining down over the skies in the Bahamas and Florida, and it impacted flight delays here in Florida, like in Orlando and Miami. When something like that happens, Ruth, I mean, walk me through just the impact that has on airspace and air traffic.
I will say it depends on the direction of the launch. There's a lot of factors that come into play based on the flight plans and flight routes. The situation with the Starship breakup in particular is that since it was an experimental launch, there was heightened awareness that there could be a post-launch incident. A lot of planning goes into that. And that planning includes preparing what's known as a hazard area. And that hazard area is so that we have advance notice if something does go wrong. They call it an off-nominal event, that we can immediately trigger the response from particularly the air traffic community to move the aircraft away from the potential debris area. So the reason we're able to do that is because we have a lot of experience with launch frequency and launch cadence in the United States. And we've developed over the years a more agile system. So the first thing that happens is the anomaly is detected and everyone goes into action to get those notifications out very, very quickly to the air traffic community, to get the instructions out to the pilots. That's why you didn't hear any safety incidents as a result of that explosion. What you do have is a lot of economic impacts. So as you mentioned, flights were delayed to in Orlando, Miami, Fort Lauderdale, because the reaction to the event disrupts the system. And we can't ignore economic impacts. We can address the safety concerns and we can do it in a very rapid response way and make sure that nobody is hurt, but it doesn't mean that the system isn't disrupted. And when you take resources and attention to address that problem, the way the system compensates for that is to slow everything else down until the emergency event is over.
You mentioned the skies are prepared for this because of an increased launch cadence in the U.S. I know that is the case here in Florida. We've seen record numbers pretty much year over year, in part due to SpaceX's increased launch cadence of the Falcon 9 rocket from Cape Canaveral and Kennedy Space Center. How does a standard nominal launch impact the skies over Florida?
Airspace is not magic. You don't have any more of it. And if more than one actor wants to be in the same airspace, the situation has to be addressed. And everyone has a right to the airspace. The airlines, general aviation, space launches. The airspace is a national asset. And the job of the government is to balance the interests of the competing parties. And one thing that we saw with the increasing commercialization of space launch is that there was more tension between different types of airspace users. And you saw the aviation users say, you know, you're disrupting us, and the space users saying, well, we have a right to launch as well. And everybody does. So yes, there is an impact. And the space community can argue that aviation is an impact to them because it restricts their access to launch windows and their freedom of access to space. But the reality is for all of us as a society is that there are benefits to having a safe and reliable air transportation system. And there are benefits to having a growing and productive space community that delivers services to the Earth. And our challenge is to find where that balance happens and not to have one competing against the other, but to improve and refine our system to minimize the impact of one on the other. And that's where the regularity of launch has actually helped. And I don't think enough attention is paid to that, because when it's a one-off and you have to design something new every time, you don't get the efficiencies out of it. It uses a disproportionate amount of resources and time. But now that we've gotten to a fairly refined system, we can reduce the length of the launch window that's necessary because the rockets have become more reliable. We can increase the usage of the airspace because the air traffic systems have become more comfortable and routine with the operations themselves. So when everything's working just fine, we're on a continual path to reduce the disruption from a space launch to commercial aviation and to increase the access that the launch community has to space. But that means that everybody's got to improve at the same time. It can't be putting the burden all on one industry or another in order to solve this problem.
Is the instance of the Starship rapid unplanned disassembly that caused the traffic issues and the ground stops across Florida last week, is that kind of an outlier because this is a new system? And as you mentioned, the regularity of quote unquote standard launches are actually helping with traffic, and something like a Starship is a once in a blue moon kind of opportunity? Or does your industry need to think about issues like Starship and debris causing events like this as you plan for future use of airspace?
I think the most important thing to look at from that direction, new rockets are a challenge and they require additional resources to do that testing and evaluation. But we have to look at that bigger picture of how do we ensure that there's an appropriate safety culture so that the pressure to launch and the pressure to demonstrate those new rockets don't override legitimate concern about the risk that we're taking when we do that. And there's a long history in both the aviation and space communities of that safety culture. And we want to make sure that that is maintained as that highest standard. And so sometimes it's important to take a little bit more time to step back and make sure that you have fully evaluated all of the elements that went into a catastrophic failure to make sure we've addressed those problems before we try and launch again. There's always that push and pull of being overly cautious and constraining development by taking a too cautious approach. But we have to make sure we hit that right balance. That Starship explosion taught us about the airspace management, the pressure to launch, is that balance is incredibly important and that we can't weigh our decisions too heavily on one side or the other. And that has always been a stressor in the safety community, in both aviation and space, is how do we balance those interests to make sure that we are not taking unnecessary risks.
Ruth, in your professional experience, I mean, what we saw from kind of eyewitness accounts of this debris was pretty dramatic, pretty stunning, seeing these streaks of fire in the sky as Starship broke up. But there was that ground stop that was issued. And how would you rate air traffic control from a safety standpoint in responding to what happened with Starship last week?
I think the reaction was extraordinary. I mean, you can see maps on FlightAware where the planes were turned very quickly. The ability of the system to respond and respond quickly, it really makes a big difference in that safety equation. Now, we shouldn't be dependent upon that ability to respond and respond quickly. We should still work to try and prevent the incidents from happening in the first place. But to make sure that we always have these layers of protection in place that we can activate so that if something goes wrong, what we're not worried about is somebody getting injured on an aircraft as a result. And so the disruption, and this has always been the case in air traffic control, you slow the system down to maintain the safety buffer. And your first action is to say safety comes first. efficiency comes second. And that was demonstrated in the reaction to the Starship explosion. And I think that the system performed well. But because you have a backup safety valve, doesn't mean that should be the thing you always are relying on. You need to prevent the incident in the first place to the extent possible. But don't eliminate that safety valve, because it is very, very important. And we need to recognize that sometimes bad things happen.
Ruth, you mentioned that there needs to be a balance between airspace users and space launch users. But we know that SpaceX is run by Elon Musk. We know that he has been outspoken about FAA regulations, especially when it comes to Starship. And one could think that he is trying to tip the scales in favor of his balance with his particular position in the administration. Are there concerns that these issues may continue to happen and there may not be as many resources or as much oversight because of the position that Musk is in?
We can't expect a CEO of a company not to act in the interest of their company. So we shouldn't be surprised by that, right? Everybody who is running a company considers regulation to be a burden. Regulation, in my perspective, is always enabling, and that it allows us to do things we couldn't do before. But there's always going to be this push for less and less regulation. And we shouldn't be surprised by that. We should anticipate that. Now, we have these issues when the issues of air traffic control privatization come up, and the airlines say we want more control over how the system runs. It's the same question. How do we make the system more profitable for us? And that's why the government keeping control of air traffic control in the United States has been very effective, because their role is to serve the interests of the American people, not one company over another. So these pressures always exist. It's kind of a unique circumstance that they're existing today, just because it is so rapid and apparent and in the news every day. But there are always interests trying to influence our government to make their business model more successful. And we need to make sure as a population that our focus is on ensuring the public interest is put first.
Finally, Ruth, we've seen a number of high-profile incidents involving air traffic. In this particular instance, is the reaction by air traffic controllers to the Starship event something that we should be celebrating and possibly looking at improving for the future?
Absolutely. And not just the air traffic controllers, but the systems that went in place to allow them to be able to do what they did. That's airspace management, airspace planning, the interaction with the traffic management community. There's a lot of things that happen before the information gets to the air traffic controller, maintaining the technology of the systems. And all of those things played a role in a successful outcome. And we don't want to ignore all of that. The air traffic controllers performed beautifully in this case, but they were able to perform that well because of the systems in place behind them that supported their ability to make those effective decisions at the moment of crisis.
We've been speaking with Ruth Stillwell. She's the Executive Director of Aerospace Policy Solutions, LLC. Ruth, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Still to come, space policy.
Morale, as you might expect, is very low. NASA has generally been rated year after year, I think every year since they started taking these surveys, the best place to work in the federal government. And in a sense, to see that go away, and you know, like most federal employees right now, that level of uncertainty, of disruption, whether they will have a job themselves or where the agency is going, its morale is very low.
The changes happening at NASA, that's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. The Voyager spacecraft are starting to show their age. Launched back in 1977, Voyager 1 and 2 are almost 50 years old, and collectively they've traveled over 29 billion with a B, miles in space, and are still sending data back to Earth. The mission was originally meant to last only about a decade, but scientists and engineers have found ways to extend the lives of the twin spacecraft, including turning off some of its equipment. We'll talk more about the Voyager mission and the efforts to keep them alive next week on Are We There Yet? But for now, we're talking about space policy. The Trump administration and the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, is attempting to cut down on federal employees, which includes NASA. The Planetary Society is also warning of proposed cuts to NASA's science division that it's calling a, quote, extinction level cut. Here to talk more about all the recent happenings in space policy is Casey Dreyer. He's the chief of space policy at the Planetary Society. Casey, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me. I wish it was under more exciting or positive circumstances.
Indeed. And let's start with kind of the news this week. NASA's closing its Office of Technology Policy and Strategy, the Office of the Chief Scientist, and the Office of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, along with a reduction in their workforce known as a RIF. What do we know about this, Casey?
Well, I think this is a prelude to a larger workforce reduction. We've seen this basically telegraphed through official policy statements and releases through NASA, and obviously through DOGE and the part of the larger Trump administration. Agencies, every single federal agency was directed to begin planning for relatively large workforce reductions. This seems like the tip of the iceberg at NASA, and in some levels, you know, a statement that more is to come.
NASA's Cheryl Warner sent out a statement saying, quote, to optimize our workforce and in compliance with an executive order, NASA is beginning its phased approach to a reduction in force known as a RIF. A small number of individuals received notification Monday they are part of NASA's RIF. If they're eligible, those employees may opt to participate in the Voluntary Early Retirement Authority or complete the RIF process. So as you mentioned, this is just the tip of the iceberg, but when we look at some of the names, Office of Technology Policy and Strategy, Office of the Chief Scientist, Office of DEI, these all seem like they could have some pretty large ripple effects throughout the agency. I know it's early, but what's your take on what this may do to NASA?
Well, it's more symbolic, I believe. I mean, the total number of people impacted by this is relatively modest. It's something like 23 people, I believe. It's the statement, I mean, you have Chief Scientist, Chief Technologist, the role of those individuals within NASA is to be in the room when decisions are being made by NASA leadership. It's to have a source, a direct source to scientific expertise, a direct source to technological capability and expertise. And then also this broader Office of Technology Policy and Strategy is, do we have an understanding, an agency-wide approach to what we're trying to do, what is needed by the agency, what would work, and what is the consequences of some of the decisions that we might make? These were all created to improve the decision-making process of leadership. And without them, it would be more of an ad hoc decision process. It will be at the discretion, likely, of the administrator and others to include individuals like that and to have that expertise represented. So it's a real shift from a broader ecumenical policy process to one that's more concentrated and distinct and, again, ad hoc.
Along with this reduction in workforce and more that could come in the near future, we are also hearing that the White House is considering a 50% cut to NASA's science activity in its 2026 fiscal year budget. Your organization, the Planetary Society, calls this extinction level cuts to NASA science. What's the implications here?
I chose that metaphor very carefully. It has the benefit of being an accurate metaphor in addition to one that I think that sticks in people's head. An extinction event is when a lot of perfectly happy species are just wiped out because of something external happens, right? That would, in a sense, be the case. If you saw a year-over-year reduction of half of your science budget, NASA would have to turn off dozens, if not more, perfectly good science missions. Voyager out in deep space. How do you keep Hubble Space Telescope operating and the James Webb Space Telescope operating? Mars rovers, you know, missions at Earth, missions at the Sun. NASA has, you know, nearly 100 active science missions. And to turn them off, in a sense, because we just decide we don't want to hear them anymore, that's what I mean. It's an extinction level event in that we just wipe out all sorts of very productive, good missions that are paying back the taxpayer investment. You would see a similar set of consequences to this entire STEM workforce pipeline that the United States has spent the last half a century building of trying to draw and attract the most talented, most capable, most ambitious individuals to come into the sciences to learn hard, you know, capabilities, science, technology, engineering, mathematics. And, you know, some of them will go to work in planetary exploration missions, but a lot of students who come in, they get their training on a Mars rover operations or working on astrophysics problems and then go on to other parts of the industrial or economic sectors. You destroy all of that. You basically no longer have money to pay for most graduate student salaries. You don't have money to pay for researchers. You don't have money to pay for, you know, the actual science part of collecting all of this data.
But also we're seeing within sciences across the country, there are cuts to other organizations like the National Science Foundation, National Institutes of Health. I mean, a 50% cut in NASA, that has a broad impact elsewhere for these scientists who are looking for funding to discover things that we don't know, right?
It absolutely does. I mean, it's certainly part of a huge disruption to U.S. scientific capabilities. Something that's worth emphasizing, NASA science funding is not replicated at any other science agency, though. A planetary scientist has no other avenues for funding for their work, which is the work that, you know, the United States has decided is important enough to collect, right, to go to the trouble of collecting this data. There's no one else except for NASA who then pays scientists to understand what we have just collected, to train the future generation of scientists and engineers and technicians to work on these types of capabilities, or again, more broadly throughout the economy. So if this goes away, they go away too.
This is a White House consideration of a 50% cut to NASA science activities in the 2026 fiscal year budget, but Congress controls the purse strings here. How likely is this to happen? What are you hearing on the Hill? Are senators and representatives in Congress game for this?
There's two aspects to this. We're reacting to reports of this consideration. So at the moment that we're recording this, this is not a formal proposal from the White House, but let's say that it is. That does set the discussion for how Congress then appropriates money. However, Congress, as many people have noticed, has not been the most functional legislative body in the last few decades. And Congress has been unable to provide appropriations, the actual, you know, authorization of the U.S. Treasury to spend money on time by October 1st at the start of the fiscal year in over 30 years. And so what happens during that interim, we're in one now, it's called the continuing resolution. On paper, you basically extend last year's funding and go forward until Congress reauthorizes something new. And you're not supposed to cancel anything, but you can't start anything either. But at the time that that's happening, the White House's budgeting office, their rule is that you have to spend at the rate lowest of all potential considerations, right? What that means then is that any delay that Congress takes in appropriating funding during that period, NASA is effectively living under that 50% cut. And so again, given what we just talked about, you don't just snap back from that. Even if you get money back on the back end, can you resurrect a mission that you've put in hibernation? Can you hire people back? Are you even able to do some of these capabilities anymore? So the consequences of even the delay of congressional action, which is likely, will be severe. So it's always better to not have the proposal out there to begin with. But even then, of course, we've seen, you know, this is going to be part of a larger scale cutbacks in government spending proposals that we're seeing, again, telegraphed through the White House and through DOGE. And within this context, even getting the attention for NASA science, I think is going to be a challenge because there'll be cut. It's an omni-crisis of spending, and where Congress is going to put their efforts and political capital to preserve what aspects is going to be a big fight going forward. It really will put space science in a very difficult position should these proposals go forward, merely by the delay of action between the proposal and the eventual congressional reaction to it.
You know, a lot of these reductions in workforces are coming from the Department of Government Efficiency, which is run by Elon Musk, who is a huge contractor with NASA and gets quite a bit of funding through NASA contractors. How is Musk influencing these decisions? And is this a conflict of interest?
We don't have any direct relationship or proof that there is a direct Elon Musk decision-making process impacting NASA. These are consequences so far of broad across government executive orders, clearly through his influence, but through the president ultimately, of how all federal agencies should be reacting. So, I mean, I think that's an important aspect here. Of everything that we've seen with NASA so far, nothing has been targeted directly at NASA. These are just broad across government directives. And so at this point, we can't really say. Now, obviously, I think there's some philosophical alignment. You know, Elon Musk is known running businesses very efficiently, cutting down to the bone, seeing what was actually needed, and then restoring people if they miss them, in a sense. That's how he approached Twitter and other of his businesses. Now, obviously, I would say government doesn't quite work the same way, but you know, it's a philosophical alignment at this point more than any sort of direct control, again, that we've seen publicly that we can comment on.
And finally, Casey, Jared Isaacman, who has ties to SpaceX, has been to space as a civilian thanks to SpaceX, has been nominated to run NASA as its administrator, have not gotten any hearings on yet, which surely lawmakers will grill him on these decisions by the White House. But has he weighed in on any of these proposals so far?
We did see him tweet over the weekend from when we are recording this that he hasn't heard of any specifics and that we don't have, you know, people shouldn't overreact to rumors. Okay, we can take that in mind. I think that's important. But what I would say to him is that these rumors are fully in line with the OMB, the Office of Management and Budget Directors, Russell Vogt. When he was out of power during the last administration, he ran a conservative think tank. And as part of that, in 2023, that think tank and his organization released a conservative budget alternative to the Biden budget at the time, with among the variety of proposals for government spending included a 50% cut to NASA science. These rumors are more than rumors. I'd say they're aligned with what has been stated before by the people who are running these offices now. And they're in line with the overall thrust of DOGE and the White House approach to staffing and spending. And it's something to be very concerned about. If this does not happen, I will be the first person to happily admit that I was wrong or overreacted. I would love to be in that position, right? And I hope they do reconsider. And I think that's the important part here is that my organization and others, we want to have this conversation now because I think it's worth exploring. There are consequences to this, and consequences are in ways that are counter to the administration's goals in spaceflight, to the administration's goals for positioning the United States within the world, and single-handedly, in a sense, surrendering U.S. leadership in exploration, turning off our presence in deep space, deeper space than any other, not just a country, a human, right, presence has ever been. That runs counter, I think, to this idea of U.S. leadership in the world, and in a sense, surrenders that role to anyone else who decides to replace it. And so this is something that I think is worth discussing the consequences of these ideas before they are implemented. I'd like to really emphasize at this point, you know, commercial space, private space has done a lot of amazing things, not just SpaceX, but other companies. We're seeing this with CLPS landing on payloads on the moon right now, that we're huge new capabilities are presented before us. But at the end of the day, for science, science is the one thing that the private industry cannot do and will not do because there isn't inherent profit in it. They're a great tool to use to get there. The missions landing on the moon right now through private companies, those are paid for by NASA. They're carrying NASA-made and paid-for instrumentation. Missions to Europa, missions out into deep space, the James Webb Space Telescope, those are paid by the public sector because we have, as a public, the responsibility to advance knowledge, to represent our highest ideals and values, and to do so in a way that shares that information broadly with the entire world. It is one of the most, I think, stunning and unique things that we do as a society. And there is no one else waiting to do that for us. There's no private or commercial alternative to NASA science. And that's what would be lost by cutting that in half.
Casey Dreyer is the chief of space policy for the Planetary Society. Casey, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on the Central Florida Public Media app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the NPR app, YouTube, or really wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with this show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at AWTY Space. If you got an idea for a future episode of the show, or if you want to join us as a guest, shoot us an email. arewetherenyet@cfpublic.org is the address to reach us. More space coverage is online. Visit cfpublic.org/space. Are We There Yet? Is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Our intern is Allison Castillo. Editorial guidance from LaToya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.